If you recall, last week we spent a little more time than I thought we would in the first part, but it was all good. We're looking at chapters 29 and 30 in Genesis, and we're looking at the birthing of a nation, literally, and the shaping of its leader, Jacob, and his maturation. By way of just a quick review to get our heads back wrapped around it, we started with the prelude to the birthing, which were the providential arrivals and encounters. You recall that Jacob set out from Beersheba, arrived at a well near Haran, right where he was supposed to be with Laban and his family, and then God providentially brought Rachel along, and he made that acquaintance and was, as we saw, pretty smitten with her from the outset. From there, we encountered who? Good old Uncle Laban, right? Good old Uncle Laban. We'd seen him before, and he races out there, well, I think fairly at this point, a genuine mixture of affection, but probably a little heavier weighting of, okay, more stuff is coming, so some greed in the process. That was followed by an employment agreement in the form of a marriage contract, if you will, for Rachel. And, of course, we know the deception that happened there. So Jacob joyfully fulfilled his part of that. The scriptures tell us that the 7 years passed as if they were just a day. And in the process then, he asked for his bride and woke up to a morning surprise in the treachery of Laban in verses 21 to 30. Now, as we go forward from here in the rest of chapter 29 and through the bulk of chapter 30, we get this recording of the birth of what will be the royal family. So we see God honoring his promises to give him many descendants. And then we'll close chapter 30 with God prospering Jacob, bringing him material possession before he returns to the land. So it records and accounts this. It's kind of a parenthetical. Remember, we've talked about this idea of parentheticals. So if you went from verse 30 of chapter 29 and we jumped forward into verse, 25 of chapter 30, it would be like we hadn't skipped a beat. So the author pauses to give us this account or this record of the sons of the royal family, which we know will later be the 12 tribes of Israel. Now we have the 11 here, right? 12th will come later on the journey back, and that will be the end of that. The organizing principle of the section, if you recall, I said, was by mother order. So you may remember this little picture we had last week. Okay, so the first was, I just simply call them group one by Leah. So four sons, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Okay, then we have the jealousy of Rebekah getting into the game. So she offers up her handmaiden, Bilhah. And Bilhah produces two sons, Dan and Naphtali. And in the ever-present game of whatever you can do, I can do better, Leah comes back and gives him her handmaiden, Zilpah, by which we have two more sons, Gad and Asher. Leah, not to be outdone, has a little bit left in the tank, and she has two more sons and a daughter, Dinah. And then finally, God remembers Rachel and gives her a son, Joseph, and then much later, the caboose, Benjamin. Okay, so that's really how the royal family came about. We're going to look at that in kind of a bit more detail today. So the organizing principle is mother order. And the centerpiece of the struggle between Rachel and Leah was basically the fact that each one had what the other one wanted, right? What did Rachel have? She had Jacob's love. Leah was, quote, unloved, okay? And what did Leah have? She had all the kiddies, right? What did Rachel want? She wanted all the kids as well. We kind of ended last week on this implication for us that discontent is the source, a very significant source of sin, right? As we have discontent in our heart, as we have envy and jealousy and all those different things, we then are subjecting ourselves to sinful responses. So, someone get us started here with verses 31 to 35, please, from chapter 29. 29, 31, 35. Someone read those, please.
Now the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb. But Rachel was barren. Leah conceived and bore a son and named him Reuben, who he said to me, "Because the Lord has seen my affliction, surely now my husband will love me." Then she conceived again and bore a son and said, "Because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he therefore you need this and also. Since she managed to find him, she jumped again into a sun and said, this time my husband will become attached to me because I have born him 3 sons. Therefore, he was named Levi. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, this time I will praise the Lord. Therefore, she named him Jesus. Then she stopped then.
Okay, so we start in this section and we have what I've just affectionately called group number one of children, right? So God initiates the action by showing mercy to the unloved Leah in verse 31. Now, does this mean that God intended for Jacob to marry Leah? Does this mean God intended for Jacob to marry Leah? Got any yeses out there? Just a bunch of noes? Okay.
Yeah,
of course, it's always safe that God's involved in everything, but as the primary, let's say, as the wife. Now, the reason I bring it up is a number of the commentaries seem to say that this is proof that God had really intended for Leah to be his mate, and I just don't see anything in the text that would suggest this to be the case. It's just the way God providentially worked it out. Rather, we see that God sees our afflictions, right, and he answers those according to his providential mercy, and possibly we see an initial lesson for Jacob on the pitfalls of partiality. So, Leah gives birth to 4 sons in rapid-fire succession, probably over a period of about 5 years, and throughout, what we're going to see is that the children's names reflect how the mothers feel about their children. They're reflecting what's going on inside of them as God gives them children. So we kind of see the story told in the children's names. So Reuben is her firstborn, and Reuben means literally see a son. Okay, so she sees a son, she's excited, and his name is Reuben. Now it comes from a compound Hebrew word, so the word is actually pronounced Reuven. And it's comprised of ra'ah, which means to see. It's the verb to see. And the word bain is the word son in Hebrew. So see a son. Okay, so she names the child in a very reflective way. The statement then is that God saw and responded to her affliction, opening her womb. And her desire is stated in the close of that, which is surely now Jacob will love me. So Leah's optimistic that this is going to change the pattern of the relationship. Well, we learn that her second son is named Simeon, and Simeon means hearing. Okay, so it means hearing. It's derived from the Hebrew word verb shema. So have everybody heard of the shema? Where do we find the shema in the Old Testament? What's that?
Deuteronomy.
Right, Deuteronomy 6, right? It says what? Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. So this is the famous Shema. That's the word Shema, that's the Hebrew word. So his name is derived from that word, meaning to hear, and it's actually pronounced Shimon, which we transliterate into something we would understand, meaning Simeon in English language. So perhaps suggesting at this point that she had been praying to the Lord for a son, and the Lord heard her. So in these first 2 sons, 1 and 2, we see basically Leah's belief that God has both seen and heard her affliction. So she's got the right mindset. She's looking to the right place in all this, and she's named her first 2 sons this way. Now, son number 3, Levi, takes another angle. Levi comes from the Hebrew word root lava, which means to join. Okay, so her thought is, okay, now I've given this guy 3 sons, surely he's going to want to become attached or joined to me. Again, remembering in the ancient Near East, the bearing of sons was a big deal. So she's hopeful. She names him Levi, reflecting how the unloved Leah longs to be joined with Jacob. Okay, so it is interesting, right? She is having many children. She's having male children. And yet, what is she focused on? His love for her, what she doesn't have. Kind of reminds you of the garden, right? What's the deal with the garden? They got everything, right? Except one thing. So what do we focus on? the one thing we don't have. I mean, it's just crazy. I was thinking about Pastor Mark's message this morning and the little faith thing. One time ministering in the northeast of China, Katie and I together were going to do a men's conference. First time ever men's conference. Now, the church is dominated by women in China. Okay, so when you come to teach, there's this side of the room filled with a bunch of women and then maybe kind of like one skinny little aisle down here with the men. So this is a network in the northeast of maybe a half a million or so believers in an underground church house network. And we said to the leader, well, why don't we do a men's conference? He said, oh, that's a great idea. That'd be wonderful. I said, how many do you think will come? What was the number, Katie?
Five.
His name is Yu Pong. I said, Yu Pong, five? Are you kidding me? Well, before this came back, we were back here for a short trip. I was up on the beach sitting with a neighbor talking, asking me, well, what's going on in the ministry, blah, 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 blah. I said, yeah, we're doing this men's conference. You know, probably nobody's going to come. And he rebuked me on the spot. And he was dead right. He said, wow, you have a lot of faith. I said, yeah, you know what? You're right. I had really poor faith. And in fact, it was interesting. So I said, okay, Lord, if it's five, that's fine. We'll have five, and I'll just have faith that you'll bring who you want to have. Well, in typical style, this guy kind of either lowballs or something. I don't know what he does. So we show up today, and I put together a class for kind of like an interactive thing for five people. And we said, so Yupong, how many are coming? Well, maybe a few more than five. I said, well, how many is a few more? Well, I don't know, maybe 30. I said, okay. And then, well, maybe 70. So how many showed up in the end, Katie? 110 showed up. So, I mean, it's God's grace, and he's in control. But then I have my second crisis of faith, which is, well, what am I going to teach? Because I prepared this little intimate thing. So God is gracious. But it is easy, right? We get so caught up. And I also like kind of the emphasis today, even though we talked about littleness of faith, faith is kind of a binary deal, right? It's either faith or unbelief. And that's what we fall into. It's the unbelief that distracts us and gets us headed in the wrong direction. So we see this, that she's focused on these things. This third son, Levi, means attached, and she wants to be attached. Now, her fourthborn is Judah. And again, she changes the focus. His name means praised. Okay, so it comes from the Hebrew root yada, which means to praise. So finally, at this fourth child, what happens now with Leah? Focus gets what? Off herself, right, and on God, okay? So she's now recognizing, okay, praise God, he's given me four children. So maybe she's beginning to be broken through this process to recognize that God's will is being done and in the process. Now, what is significant about this fourth son? What's significant about this fourth son, Judah? Okay, it's from the messianic line. It's going to follow from Judah, okay? So from this fourth son will come the messianic line. It's kind of interesting. His name, which is Yehuda, is very close to the Hebrew word for salvation, which is Yeshua. Okay, so you see kind of a little play on the words, which they do. But basically, through this fourth son is going to come the messianic line. So we see this from the beginning. So Leah was unloved, but she was one of the women in the messianic line. We're going to see kind of a similar story with Tamar when we get up to, what, chapter 38, in terms of her being unloved. So, Leah stops bearing, and it leads us to Rachel's response and group 2. So, in group 2, somebody read verses 1 to 8, please. Chapter 30, verses 1 to 8.
Now, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister, and she said to Jacob, give me children, or else I will die. Then Jacob's anger burned against Rachel, and he said, am I in the place of God, who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? She said, here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her, that she may bear on my knees, that through her I too may have children. So she gave him the maid Bilhah as a wife, and Jacob went into her. Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, God has vindicated me and has indeed heard my voice and has given me a son. Therefore she named him Dan. Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. So Rachel said, with mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and I have indeed prevailed. And she named him Naphtali.
Okay, so here we go. Group two, the children by Rachel's handmaid, Bilhah. Okay, now they are truly her children. She had the right to name them. She was her handmaiden. And in verse 1, we see that the loved Rachel's jealous reaction to her blessing, right? So she raises a bit of a complaint with a little drama thrown in, right? And I think Carl gave us a nice translation of that. Give me children, else I'm gonna die. Okay, so she's putting the heat on him, all right? And what is wrong with her demand? What's wrong with this demand?
She's putting the blame on Jacob.
Yeah, okay, exactly. It's completely unreasonable and it borders on sinful, suggesting she feels wronged in this barrenness, right? Now, why is it unreasonable and sinful?
It's the Lord that opens the womb.
Beautiful. She's forgotten the source of children, right? So she's effectively questioning the wisdom of God. So let's look at Psalm 127. It kind of states it nicely. 127 and verses 3 to 5. The psalmist captures this idea. So in 127, verses 3 to 5, he says this, "Behold, children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate." So children are indeed a gift of God. So all you young parents, when you're exasperated, what do you remember? You remember those lovely little gifts that you have, right?
After you get done screaming at them.
Okay. No, you wouldn't do that. I know. But look, the Lord opens the womb, right? So I think that Jacob, what do you think about his response? What do you think about Jacob's response?
It's probably,
yeah. Yeah? Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to say it's mixed, just like everything in this chapter. Okay. It's a bit of a mixed response. It's both good and bad. So what's the good part? What's the good part of his response?
Speaking the truth to God.
Yeah.
But like many men, he's being too cold.
Ah, well, you went ahead and answered both questions, so you get the gold star for the day. Okay. He is speaking the truth, but he dropped that New Testament add-on. What's the preposition that goes with that in the New Testament? Speak the truth, what?
In love.
In love, right? So we get the truth part right. Us men are really good at that part, correct? And we're kind of a little weak on the in love part sometimes. So he's right, and he ascribes the barrenness to God's providence, right? So he is correct in stating that. But he shows absolutely no compassion for Rachel, right, in the process. But more importantly, I think he exhibits a complete lack of spiritual leadership, right? So what's he say? Just yells at her, basically. Is it my fault? Does he sit down and pray with her? Does he coach her? Does he lead her to Scripture? At least what they would have had is Scripture at that point in time? Well, no. Okay, so we see a really poor reaction in regard to how he's managing and leading in his family. So, while this was an acceptable practice in their culture, Rachel shows little faith and patience. It's kind of funny. I don't plan these with what Mark ends up preaching every week, but here we go. What does she show? Very little faith or patience in the process. It's kind of interesting because this is now the third generation of barrenness, right? So each of these kind of leading ladies each time has struggled with this barrenness, and they've each responded with their husbands in a different way. So with Abram and Sarai, they responded with what? Disbelief and laughter, right? And what did it end up leading to? Surrogacy and strife, right? Okay, so we saw the whole pattern there. Then we have Isaac and Rebekah. Now, they were a pretty good model, weren't they? They responded to the barrenness with prayer and patience. And even though it took a while afterwards, they received God's blessing in God's way, in God's time. So you would think that perhaps Jacob had a good role model here in the process. But again, Jacob and Rachel respond with what? Jealousy and anger, right? And again, leading to what? Surrogacy on steroids and strife. Okay, so just kind of a crazy process of going through it. So Rachel has these two children by Bilhah. She names the first one Dan, which means vindicated. It comes from the Hebrew word din, which is means to judge or to be vindicated. So what's wrong with her choice of name? What's wrong with that name?
Not
what's that?
Not vindicated.
Right. She wasn't really vindicated. She's incorrectly ascribing the success of her plan to God. This is not vindication. This is providence, for sure. But it's certainly not vindication. She's not judging. She's vindicating herself, I guess, maybe of her improper response. But I don't think it's a very good reflection. We see kind of her spiritual condition in the process. And I think as we continue to see the story go on, what we can begin to conclude is part of what God wants to do is break her of her sinfulness, break her of her ungodly responses to things. And then when he has broken her of that, then he's going to open her womb and allow her to have children. So she names the second one Naphtali, and if you couldn't guess from the text what that means, she was wrestling. She was doing a lot of wrestling. Okay, so literally it comes from the word patal, which means to wrestle, or I kind of like this idea of to twist. She's kind of twisting and turning and trying to get everything to work out in her favor. So Rachel's real heart, I think, is revealed in this, right? So it's not that she just wants children per se. She's wrestling for something, and that's this preeminence. She's already got the preeminence in terms of Jacob's love, but she also wants the preeminence in terms of the children as well. She wants it to be clear that she's queen of the roost, in the process. I don't know that he's king. All right, so let's go on to group three here, verses 9 to 13.
When Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, she took her maid Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son, and Leah said, "How fortunate." So she named him Gad. Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. Then Leah said, "Happy am I, for women will call me happy." So she named him Asher.
Okay, so again, you know, you can see from the text they're recording what these names mean as they reflect their emotions as they go through it. So not to be outdone, right? She offers up Zilpah with the old pattern of whatever you can do, I can do better, right? So she goes back to Zilpah. And well, fortunately, this time, Jacob's got it right, right? He responds well this time, does he? A lot of low energy today. Is that a yes or a no? Okay, well, okay, I'll help you. Wrong, right? He doesn't. What's he do? He just follows orders, and he goes into Zilpah, and they bear two more sons to Jacob, right? So at some point, you got to start saying, "Hey, Jacob, when do you get, wake up." Who said that? Perfect. Wake up. Wake up, Jacob. Smell the roses. See what's going on here. Okay, so the name of the first child is Gad, which comes from Gadav, which means fortunate or fortune. So her good fortune, yet another son. Okay, so she's up to how many now? Five. From her brood. Name of the second one is Asher, which means happy or blessed. Again, comes from the same Hebrew root, Ashar, which means to pronounce happy or to call blessed. And in fact, it kind of captures both ideas, right? She's both happy, and in the eyes of ancient Near East culture, she would have been perceived as blessed in the process. Okay? So, Jacob, at this point in my mind, is one of three things. He's either clueless, right? Or he's completely apathetic, right? Or he's a wimp, okay? I don't see anything really redeeming about him at this point. He's taking no spiritual leadership in the household. He's just kind of running around doing what his wife's telling him to do. So, you women, if you think it's a good model for your husbands to do whatever you tell them to do, let me just refer you to this text, okay? It's not always a good idea. Now, as David said, men need to lead sacrificially and in love, right? You've got to get that part right. But the fact of the matter is, he's just not responding very well to any of the process. So, at this point, you got to ask yourself, surely it can't get worse, can it? Can it get worse?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, it does. All right, somebody read verses 14 to 21.
And Reuben went in the days of wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field and brought them unto his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, "Give me, I pray thee, of thy son's mandrakes." And she said unto her, "Is it a small matter that thou hast taken my husband? And wouldst thou take away my son's mandrakes also?" And Rachel said, Therefore, he shall lie with thee tonight for thy son's dandruff. And Jacob came out of the field in the evening, and Leah went out to meet him and said, thou must come in unto me, for surely I have hired thee with my son's dandruff. And he lay with her that night. And Leah said, and God hearkened unto Leah, and she conceived and bare Jacob the fifth son. And Leah said, God hath given me my hire, because I have given my maid to my husband, and she called his name Issachar. And Leah conceived again, and bare Jacob the sixth son. And Leah said, God hath endued me with a good dowry. Now will my husband dwell with me, because I have borne him six sons. And she called his name Zebulun. And afterwards she bare a daughter, and called her name Dinah.
Okay, so just when you think they can't get any more sordid, we encounter the matter of the mandrakes, okay? Now, a mandrake was considered to be both an aphrodisiac and promoting fertility back in that time. So little Reuben, some 4 or 5 years of age, had toddled out into the harvest field and was drawn to these colorful mandrakes, which were sometimes called love apples. So I had to see what a mandrake looked like. Fortunately, we have the internet. So that's what a mandrake is. It looks kind of like spinach or something, but they look like little gold apples, okay? That's what a mandrake actually is. They're quite common in that part of the world. So he went there. Obviously, he was probably drawn to the color, right, as he saw them. And he collects them, as a little child will do, picks them for his mother and presents them to her, attracting Rachel's interest, okay? So this must have been quite a household. I mean, these two sisters running around all the time. I mean, I get a little sympathy for Jacob. It might have been a little hard to manage. But nevertheless, he wasn't doing a very good job. So she seems to ask politely enough, right? But she gets a sharp retort from Leah. Now, what's wrong with Leah's reply to Rachel? What's wrong with her reply?
She says that Rachel stole her husband. Really, in my opinion, Leah stole Rachel's husband back on the first wedding night.
Okay, well, there you go. It's always good to pay attention to the text. Exactly right. I mean, where do you come off with this? Right? I didn't steal anything. You snuck in and stole them on the wedding night. Okay, so she has things backwards. She was the one doing the husband stealing. So what is Rachel's solution to her desperation? What's the solution? Well, she wants to get pregnant, but what's the solution here? She wants the mandrakes, right? Make a trade. Kind of the worst kind of trade you can see, right? More than a trade, she hires him out, right? I'm going to hire him out for the mandrakes, which is a little ironic, right? Because Jacob commandeered the birthright for a bowl of stew, and now he's being commandeered for a few love apples. That's all about the food. Exactly right. So, you know, it's just amazing. I mean, so the solution is to hire him out. Now, fortunately, Jacob comes home from work. Leah beckons him. She doesn't even say, come spend the night with me. She says, I paid for you. Come on in. Right? I mean, look what it says in the text. I'm not making it up. I mean, it's amazing. Okay? I hired you for the night. I wish I could know what he was thinking. I just wish I could know. But fortunately, the Bible doesn't tell us. And it'll be one of my questions for him when I get up there, if I get to ask any questions. But certainly, it's on my list. So finally, good old Jacob says, enough is enough. I'm not doing this anymore. Right?
Wrong.
No, not Jacob. Wrong again. He acquiesces. And Leah has her last stand, bearing two more sons and a daughter. Okay? So first son, or fifth, is Issachar, which means reward, or literally, it means a man of wages. Okay? So, at least she's honest. Okay? I'll give her that. She gives the honest answer to what he comes from. And so, it comes from these two words, Ish, a man, and Sakar, which means wages. And then the second, her sixth, is named Zebulun, which means honor. Okay? So, God has honored me with all these sons. So, she certainly expects to win Jacob's favor. And for her, the honor would be that he would finally say, okay, this is my wife, I'm going to live with her and stay there. But, as we know, it doesn't go that way. So Leah's final recorded birth is a daughter, Dinah. And why do we get a daughter amongst all these men? I mean, it's all guys up to now. Why do we get a daughter? Surely some other daughters have been born along the way. Yeah, a particular daughter, right? A particular daughter that we're going to see later has some significance in Genesis 34. So he's just seeding the story, right, for a little bit later, so it's not a big surprise when we encounter Dinah in a couple of chapters here. Now, how does the text confirm that the mandrakes are powerless?
Well, we have some time that goes on, and three children are born to Leah.
Okay, so Rachel gets the mandrakes and Leah gets the kids. So they seem to work backwards, okay? So just a little point. He was only hired for a night, but apparently he stayed for more than one. Or maybe it was a multi-night deal. I don't know how they cut it. Maybe it was more than one mandrake. The whole point of it is it's rather sordid when you think of the whole story. So debunking the magic of the mandrakes. Okay, verses 22 to 24. Okay, so typical Hebrew narrative, right? Remember how I tell you, you got to get the introduction, you get the context, you get this long plot line, you hit the climax, and then boom, right? So all these verses up till now, and all these different kids, God finally opens up her womb. What do we get? Three verses on Rachel, right? So finally, Sordid Fare comes to the end. He remembers Rachel's plight. You know, perhaps she's finally accepted and understood. We're not told in the text, but I get a sense that finally she has understood and accepted God's fate in her life. So now he comes back and blesses her with a child. So after all this drama, three verses on her blessing, she names her son Joseph, which is actually a double meaning, capturing two ideas. The first idea is the idea of taking away her approach, which comes from the Hebrew word asaf, and the other idea is may he add, which comes from the Hebrew word yesaf. Okay, so she's finally gets a child, right? And what's her first reaction?
I want another one.
Yeah, give me another one, right? So where was the thanks? Where was the, okay, God, I finally get it. But so she's learning. She's got her child, okay, but obviously she just wants more. So a couple of closing thoughts on this section before the next. You know, God will honor Rachel's request here for another son, right? But she's going to die in childbirth, right? So she will get another son, which is Benjamin. Secondly, the whole section is a sordid story, yet it is how God brings about the 12 tribes, right? So it's a sordid story, but it is how God works and how he honors his promise of many descendants. And then the children's names themselves tell us the story. We kind of see the emotional interplay and the thoughts and the desires of each of the women, the two primary, obviously, poor Bilhah and Zilpah, they're just carriers in the process. They don't have anything to say. But we hear their desires, reflecting desires, their hurt, and their rivalry. Now, I can just imagine for a minute what a cat fight between these two sisters might have sounded like, right? So here's kind of how it goes. Rachel starts, "You're not loved," right? And what does Leah say? "I have two words for you, Rachel. Reuben, Simeon." "What's Reuben?" "God heard me, and God saw me." "So what do you have to say to that?" And she says, "Besides, you're barren." And what does Rachel say? "Well, let me remind you, Leah, Dan, God vindicated me, he's given one. And Naphtali, I've wrestled and prevailed." So they just kind of threw the kids' names around all day long. That's what I figured they did when they had an argument or something like that. Something we'd never do. But the fact of the matter is, the names actually tell a story, okay? And they tell us the story of the process. And so on. So in the end, Leah gets the priestly and the messianic lines, okay? So it is kind of interesting. Both Levi, which was the priestly line, came through her third son, and through her fourth son comes the messianic line, while Rachel got the line of inheritance. Okay, so Joseph got the inheritance or the possessions of the household. So each of the two daughters got something in the process. So having fulfilled the descendants' blessing, God proceeds to bless Jacob materially in the second part. So go back and remember what God said to him back in chapter 28. What did he say? "I'm going to do this. I'm going to give you many descendants. I'm going to send you to the land. I'm going to make you prosperous. And I'm going to bring you back." So what are we seeing in this whole process? First the descendants, now the prosperity. And then when we get to 31 to 33, starting next week, we'll start to see how God brings him back to the land in the process. So somebody read verses 25 to 36 for me, please.
came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, send me away, and I may go to my own place, to my country. Give me my wives and my children, for whom I have served you, and let me go, for you know my service which I have done for you. And Laban said to him, Please stay if I have found favor in your eyes, for I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake. Then he said, name your wages, and I will give it. So Jacob said to him, you know how I have served you and how your livestock has been with me. For what you had before, I came with little, and it has increased to a great amount. And the Lord has blessed you since my coming. And now, when shall I also provide for my own house? So he said, what shall I give you? And Jacob said, you shall not give me anything. If you will do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep your flocks. Let me pass through all your flocks today, removing from there all the speckled and spotted sheep and all the brown ones among the lambs, and the spotted and speckled among the goats. And these shall be my wages. So my righteousness will answer for me in time to come. When the subject of my wages comes before you, everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and brown among the lambs will be considered stolen if it is with me. And Laban said, oh, that it were according to your word. So he removed that day the male goats that were speckled and spotted, all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, everyone that had some white in it, and all the brown ones among the lambs, and gave them into the hand of his sons. Then he put 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flocks.
Okay, so now we get to the section here where God is going to begin to prosper Jacob. And it's going to proceed in two parts. This first part in 25 to 36, which we just read, is what I call the prelude to parting. Okay, kind of four things are going on here. Jacob recognizes after his 11th son, it's probably time to return to the land, which Laban quite expectedly resists. To which Jacob cites the need to provide for his family, leading to the terms of a service and release agreement, as I term it. And then in stage two, in verses 37 to 43, we're going to record how God actually goes about prospering Jacob in building his herds in the process. So after the birth of Rachel's first and his 11th son, he does realize, okay, it's time to go back to the land. Right, so this is likely would have been somewhere near the end of the 14th year of Jacob's service. And why would we know that, or how would we know that?
11 children.
Well, 11 children's one good idea. But remember, he had different wives sprinkled in there, so he can kind of do things in parallel.
The 2 7-year
contracts. There you go, that's right. Okay, he had made these 2 7-year contracts, right? And Jacob has proven to have a lot of integrity, I think, in terms of what he did. So he wasn't asking for early release. So it's probably somewhere near the end of the 14th year. His terms of service were up, and he says, okay, we need to go back to the land. Now, what does Jacob ask Laban for? What does he want?
His children and his wives.
That's right. He just asked for the wives and the children, all right? What is absent from his request?
Anything else?
All right, anything else? I got to start working on these questions better. You guys are too quick on me. He's right, anything else, but specifically with regard to any of the profit from his service, right? You would have expected that he would have sent him away with some of the profit of his labors in the process, but all Jacob wants is his wives and his children, okay? Now, what do we learn about Laban in verse 27? What do you learn about him in verse 27? Something about his spiritual condition.
He's perceptive.
Well, he is perceptive, right? But how did he perceive it?
He got blessed.
No, well, that's right. But how did he perceive that he was blessed? Okay, he's a
Jacob's little.
Yeah, go ahead.
Just his proximity to Jacob.
Yeah. Yeah, but the point of the word in here, and it is the word, the actual word, is he divined it. Okay, so he's using kind of pagan rituals to figure it out. Now, there's also all the obvious things you said. I mean, he's watched it, he's seen it, and so forth. So I've divined, right, of the Lord is the source of the blessing. So he gets it part right, right? He does realize where the blessing's coming from, but he's using pagan ritual to say how he discerned that in the process. So obviously Laban has no desire to release Jacob because he knows he's his meal ticket. So he proposes yet another business deal, right? Everything with Laban's a business deal. He figures Jacob's just motivated by a matter of price. And he's so magnanimous, right? Name me a price. I'll agree to it. Whatever you want, right? Is that Laban? Probably not. Now, what's interesting about Jacob's reply? What's interesting about Jacob's reply? What's that? He declined it. Exactly right. Okay, he doesn't bite on this pay for hire deal. Right? Remember I said, pay attention to this later. Remember what he tried to do initially when he came? He said, oh yeah, you know, what should your wages be? You're not going to be staying here for nothing. He says, no, I don't want any wages. I'll work for 7 years and I'll take Rachel as my wife. So, you know, Jacob is a wise guy. Had a little neighbor at one time, a little five-year-old boy, and we went over to the house on Christmas, and they had a little manger scene. And his mother said, oh, well, tell Mr. Smith who it is. He says, well, it's baby Jesus and the three wise guys. So he must have had the Italian version of the manger scene. But so he doesn't bite on the pay-for-hire deal, just as back in 29. Okay, he's not going to get himself in an untenable situation with Jacob, or with Laban. He does affirm what Laban has divined, right? Yahweh is the source of the blessing, and it has been an abundant blessing, okay? When I got here, you didn't have diddly, and now you got a lot. So he's making it very clear. And he articulates the motive behind his request, okay? He wants to begin providing for his family, which is a reasonable motive, right? I mean, he knows at some point in time he's got to do that. Now, Laban switches gears in the first part of verse 31. So basically, he's made his first thrust, and Jacob's parried and said, okay, no, we're not going down that path. So he takes a different angle in verse 31. Is he granting Jacob his release in 31? Do you think he's granting his release? Okay, got a no. Everybody's shaking no. Nobody wants to bite on my trick questions anymore. Okay, it's hard to be dogmatic, right? But I think the inference is, what shall I give you to stay? Okay? So what shall I give you? So first it's, you know, tell me your wages and I'll pay it. And now it's like, well, what shall I give you? Now it doesn't say. It could be that he's saying, okay, you know what? He's earned his thing. I'll give him some flocks and he can go. But I don't think that's the implication. So ever the wise one, Jacob will not accept any gifts either, right? So he's not going to pay for hire deal. He's not taking any gifts. What does he do instead? What's his counterproposal? What's Jacob's counterproposal?
He says, you know, I'll take the spotted sheep, the spotted goats.
Right.
Take the goats, you know, whatever. You know, let's just split it up.
Okay, so he proposes a work release deal. He says, give me these ones, okay, and I'll continue to keep and protect those ones. Okay, we'll separate them to make sure there's no confusion. He takes the very clearly different looking ones, and he says, that'll be my deal. Now, he'll continue to pasture and keep Laban's flock in return for building his own family's nest egg from that point forward. Okay, so pretty reasonable deal. Now, what's intriguing about Jacob's proposal?
Well, in the end, he's got to get more than he originally asked for. Because he really just wanted to go away with his wife's children.
Yeah, that's right.
Now he's got livestock too.
Yeah, now he's going to have some livestock. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. That's a good thought. I hadn't thought about that. And he does end up getting more than he wanted for. I think what it is a demonstrable act of faith. It's one of the first times we see Jacob exercising some faith. Okay? Now, why? Why is this an exercise of faith? Why is he demonstrating faith in this?
Or he's going to see.
Go ahead.
Somebody else has it.
No, go ahead.
He's exercising faith in that he makes a choice, and he knows he's making this choice before God.
Right. Okay.
And so his faith is in that God is going to continue to prosper him.
Okay.
And whether he prospers later or not, it really doesn't matter.
Okay. Yeah.
He's looking to the Lord to bring about his nest egg.
I think that's the ultimate part, Roger. What were you going to say there? The biologist is going to weigh in here.
Yes, I am. Actually, he's taking the worst of the flock.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right.
He's taking the ones that they would never want to give to God.
Yeah.
because they're spotted, they're different, they're bad.
Well, yeah. So partially, the probability of the probability of acquiring any real significant amount is genetically improbable. Okay? It's genetically improbable. So the thing you have to understand is you need to understand the normal makeup of these herds. Okay, so these Bedouin herds. So first the animal types. I had to look up what the difference between a sheep and a lamb was, being the city boy that I am. So a lamb is just a first year sheep. So them's the ones you eat. It's mutton when they become sheep, right? So the fact is that sheep and lamb are the same class, right? And goats are an entirely different genus, okay? Different animal type. Now, genetically, what you need to know is this. The Bedouin goats are predominantly dark brown or black. Okay, so that's the dominant gene producing dark brown and black. The sheep are predominantly white. Okay, so that's the genetic dominant gene. So therefore, the speckled, spotted, striped, and black offspring arise from the pairing of two recessive genes. Okay? So two recessive genes. If the dominant genes are these colors, these are two recessive genes. So he's effectively asking for the genetic minority as his compensation. So he's asking for the short end of the stick. All right? So here's how it works. I did my homework. Roger, you can weigh in here. Do you know this guy, right? So Reginald Punnett, a British geneticist, came up with this little tic-tac-toe game. What's it really called, Roger? I can't remember the real name, but some kind of chart, the genetic chart that he comes up with, looks like a tic-tac-toe game. So on the left and on the first column in the first row shows a dominant A and a recessive A gene in a parent and a mother and a father parent. So if you have this combination, you're going to get one child that has both dominant genes, right? The blue gal. Two, they're going to have the dominant and the recessive gene, the two green ones in the middle, and then finally, one that'll have the two recessive genes, okay? So basically, he's got a 25% chance of growing his flock. This is why they separate the two, okay? So it's all the dominant gene ones with his recessive gene in there. So he's basically buying off on saying, I'll take the minority one, which is why I think we're seeing a statement of faith here. Now, it's probably a statement of prudence as well, because they're all smart enough to know that they're going to get more of these than these, right? So he's certainly not going to ask for the big group, but yet genetically this is what it's doing. So obviously Jacob knew that he would not come up empty. He'd get something. But ultimately, as Doug said, he's relying on God's providence to tip the scales in his favor, right? That's just straight probability. It can turn out different than that and will turn out different than that when you've got God's providential hand in it. So what's absent from the terms of the agreement? What's kind of interesting? There's one thing that Jacob doesn't set in this agreement up front. Exactly, a timeline, which is kind of interesting, right? So no term of service. All right, so what do you think he's implying? What does that imply, possibly? What's that? Open-ended. It's open-ended, yeah, that's for sure. Well, if there's no timeline. So I think it's possible that Jacob wasn't planning to leave. Okay? Now I'm speculating, okay, right? I can't prove this dogmatically, although when we get to chapter 31 next week, I think I can prove it. Okay? Because when we see how God responds to this thing, right, he's going to respond kind of like how God responded in the New Testament in the book of Acts, right? What did they say? Go, boom, 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 boom. What did they do? They all stayed. What did God do to get them on the move? He martyred Stephen, right? Brought persecution, kicked them out. So we're going to see some of that similarly there. So, which I think will be confirmed when we get to the next chapter. So, make sure we understand the specifics, because I got to tell you, I had to read this section about 10 times because I couldn't figure out who was on first. It's like, wait a minute, I couldn't get it. So, Jacob proposes to separate all the non-standards, okay? Which will be his wages, right? That's what he said. I'm going to take this these variegated ones, effectively, they're mine, okay? And he separated the two herds. So it would seem that the non-standard sheep are his grub stake, right? So I would get that. Okay, I got a grub stake. I can breed them, and I can reproduce ones. And so in that group, the odds will be in my favor, right? Because it's that same formula backwards. Its approach is intended, I think, to provide clear demarcation between what belongs to Laban and what belongs to Jacob. So that's all straightforward. I get that. But then, how does Laban respond to the deal? What's the first thing he says?
Good.
Exactly. Goody, goody, goody. That looks like it's in my favor again. I'll take it. Behold, as it was you say, will do. Okay, good old Laban. Greedy delight and distrust. He readily accepts the deal. And then he starts altering the deal right out of the gate. Right? He starts changing the deal right there. So what are the changes? What does he do? What's he changing right out of the gate?
He takes all the spotted on the range.
He does what?
He takes all the sheep that belong to Jacob.
Yeah. So this is probably getting confused about, like, well, wait a minute. Okay, so three things, basically. He does the separating. Jacob said, I'll do the separating. It's like, come on, dude. I mean, white and black. We get the difference between those are spotted and speckled, right? Laban assigns the shepherding of the off-color flock to his sons. So what did Jacob said he'd do? I'll take care of both flocks. I'll separate them. Now, his integrity has been outstanding at this point in time. Laban would have no reason to distrust him, right? And then, what's he do? Moves them 3 days away. No way. Those speckled guys are getting in with the regular colored guys to produce anything that might come out in your favor. So Laban starts right off by altering the deal. Now, how would you like this guy as your father-in-law? Not. Okay. So the confusing part for me was this, okay, and I won't belabor it. Did Jacob intend for the initially separated group to be his grubstake? Okay, so remember he said, I'll take these ones, you take these ones, we'll separate them, I'll care for both. Or did Laban understand the offer to mean that I'll separate them and then I'll take the genetic minority that comes out of just the regular colored sheep? Okay, so I think that's really what's happening. I think Laban understood the deal to mean that whatever striped, spotted, speckled, or black that came out of these pure ones would start to build his grub stake, okay? And then just to make sure that in his absence, you know, Jacob didn't sneak a couple of the spotted boys over there, right? He took them and separated them to a different area, okay? So that's where, I mean, I went around and around on this, and I think that's really what they would have understood it to be, okay? So he really wasn't asking for anything up front. He was just asking for that minority that would come out in this way to start to build his herd in the process. Okay? Make sense? Okay. So, I honestly don't know, but I lean towards the latter. It does shed some light on the future statement. Your father keeps changing the deal. Okay, so obviously he starts being successful in this method, and it goes further. Okay, whatever the truth is, Jacob sets out to work with what he has, which also makes God's providential hand in Jacob's prosperity all the more clear, right? So now we know he's only got these, you know, regularly covered sheep and goats. And all the other speckled ones are gone. So whatever comes out of that is either going to be the genetic probability, and if all of a sudden it becomes imbalanced, we're going to see clearly God's hand in the process, which is what we'll see next week. And in fact, God will even tell him that's how that worked out next week. So he starts in faith, but he does need to provide a little helping hand. Okay? So he started out. So I'll read 37 to 43 so we can try to get out of here at a reasonable time. Then Jacob took fresh rods of poplar and almond and plane trees and peeled white stripes in them, exposing the white which was in the rods. He set the rods which he had peeled in front of the flocks, in the gutters, even in the watering troughs where the flocks came to drink. And they mated when they came to drink. So the flocks mated by the rods, and the flocks brought forth striped, speckled, and spotted. Jacob separated the lambs and made the flocks face toward the striped and all the black in the flock of Laban. And he put his own herds apart and did not put them with Laban's flock. Moreover, when the stronger of the flock were mating, Jacob would place the rods in the sight of the flock in the gutters so they might mate by the rods. But when the flock was feeble, he did not put them in. So the feebler were Laban's and the stronger Jacob's. So the man became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks and female and male servants and camels and donkeys. Okay, so despite the initial faith, right, what does he go to? Well, I'm going to have to give God a little helping hand here, right? I'm going to have to kind of come up with some methods to get it along the way. So shaken by by Laban's work and shakes his rod. So what's the helping plan? What's the character of the helping plan? Voodoo. With a mixture of truth thrown in. Right? So what's the truth? Okay, he did his voodoo when the stronger ones were there, so genetically he was trying to get the stronger flock. Well, that makes sense. That's going to play out genetically. The stronger are going to produce stronger. But these stripes and these cutting the peels and so forth. And so what are the two aspects of the helping plan? One is this idea of conception influence, right? Co-conception influence. He sets these before them as they're mating, and that's supposed to, I guess, somehow influence them to produce those kinds of offspring. I guess I should have known that. Selective breeding, which he does use, right? So he's doing selective breeding with the stronger ones there. So Roger, you get your day in the sun here. You're our resident biologist. Are you familiar with any theories or science behind the conceptual influence plan? Okay. No. From our biologist. Which, nevertheless, some reliable commentators suggest that Jacob had special knowledge of genetics yet undiscovered. So this is why, when you read commentaries, you have to be careful, okay? Some of them are downright funny. Now, these are some good commentators, by the way, that are saying, well, no, he just understood things about genetics. And like, all right, maybe it's true. We just haven't discovered it yet. So maybe at one point we're going to find out. But I think not. Rather, the text is preparing the way for God to display his providence, okay? And that's, I think, all we're getting. Now, what implication might we draw from Jacob's actions? What implication should we draw from what Jacob did? Kind of along the lines of our lesson today in the main tent, all right? Faith requires trust and endurance, right? We shouldn't be shaken by every twist and turn. So faith really does require, trust and endurance. So he did start out in faith. But then he kind of wavered and got weak when he saw Laban pulling his tricks, and he tried to come up with his own plan there. So if 39 suggests that the plan worked, which 31 will debunk, rather it just conveys the genetically disproportionate yield. So basically what the text is telling us is out of this stock that you would have intended to produce only 25% speckled and spotted, he's starting to get a disproportionate number of those, right? So he's setting us up for what's happening. Which Jacob faithfully separates, right? So he honors his deal. He pulls them apart. So they're not going to produce the other part. And then he engages in some of his own unsavoring tactics, right? He puts the wimpy ones over there without the strings, and he puts the strong ones over there with his conceptual influence, and somehow he thinks this is all working. So the section closes in verse 43 with a statement of the extent of Jacob's prosperity. The literal text is kind of funny. It says, "And the man increased exceedingly, exceedingly." That's what it says in the Hebrew. So not only was he successful in breeding, but he also acquired servants, camels, and donkeys, all paving the way for the events of the Exodus, which is what we'll begin to see next week. So before we leave, what's noticeably missing in the account from Jacob, 37 to 43? What do we not see? Huh? Well, we don't see God, but more specifically, we don't see any thanksgiving or recognition of God, right? He thinks he's pulling this all off with his own trickery again. So we kind of see this recurring pattern that we've seen with Jacob, reminding us that we need to be conscious of God's grace in our lives and praise him in thanksgiving, right? And we need to give a high view to God and a low view to man, right? So what was the deal that drove him? Fear of man, right? Laban was going to turn the tables on God. I don't think so, but that's what we saw. So, closing thoughts. God uses people as they are to achieve his purposes, but that's all he has to work with. Just because God does use somebody doesn't mean they're saved. But this is my favorite one. I can't imagine another book that's supposed to be the basis of somebody's faith, right, would record with such candor the weaknesses of its heroes and events so contrary to the ideals it proclaims. So when anybody says the Bible is made up, all you have to do is get them to read a couple of these chapters and ask them a simple question. If you were trying to write a book that you were going to get people to follow, is this what you would put in it? I don't think so, right? But it's amazing. So why would we not trust the truth? Because we see both the weaknesses of the heroes, we see all this unsavory behavior, But yet, out of all this, what happens? God rises up, the phoenix out of the dust, and we see that process. So that completes the sojourn to Haran. Next week, we're going to move on to the journey in chapter 31 to 33, which will be the journey home.